WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Joe Meek was an eccentric British record producer who passed on the chance to record an unknown band called the Beatles. Aside from that, his track record was pretty good. 45 of his records made the top 50 in England. Two of those records were hits in the U.S., Telstar in 1962 and Have I the Right in 64. Now we can hear those and the hits that never made it to America, oddball records that reflect Meek's preoccupations with the spirit world, outer space, horror, and Buddy Holly. The new anthology of his recordings was compiled by my guest Dennis Dykin of the American band The Smithereens. Meek created cheap special effects to generate the otherworldly sounds he wanted for his records, records such as this tribute to the first communications satellite, Telstar. Dennis Dykin, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Now, a lot of our listeners will remember Telstar from when it was a hit in 62 and 63. What makes this record special to you now?
I think right off the bat, what's special about it is that it holds up extremely well. It was a very unusual record in its day, and I think it's still very unusual in the same way, you know, with the passing of time and advances, quote unquote, in technology and so forth, and with all the changes in popular music, I think Telstar by the Tornadoes is as delightfully unusual and bizarre and beautiful as it was back in upon its release in October of 62.
What's the lead instrument on this? It sounds kind of like a guitar and kind of like a synthesizer. I can't quite place it.
Actually, it's a small battery-operated keyboard called a clavioline. It's a French invention, and it's a monophonic instrument, which means you cannot play chords on it. You could only play a single note at a time. And it had a lot of different settings and sounds you could get from it. Pretty much the forerunner of the synthesizer, you can say. First started out as a battery-operated unit, then later became transistorized.
Did Joe Meek break a lot of rules in the studio?
He certainly did. You got to understand, in the 50s and early 60s in Britain, all the engineers and producers wore white lab coats to work. And it was a very strict and staid type of situation. And Joe just came in and just did things his way and would strong-arm people that opposed him. He would use any of his own devices to his own homemade echo units and compressors and... Another thing that Joe did on his records that wasn't really done prior to his work was a very pronounced upfront drum sound. The British records of the time were very boomy and roomy sounding, and he brought the drums to the foreground with close mic drums. They were very often just mic'd from above or just in the room somehow, but he would go to great lengths to make the drum sound very upfront. And of course, this is pretty prevalent today.
Now, I want to play another Joe Meek production that I think Americans will be familiar with. This is The Honeycombs and Have I the Right?
Have I the right to hold you? You know I've always told you that we must never, ever part. I've loved you from the very start.
Okay, that record was made in the summer of 64. Where does this fit into Joe Meek's world?
I think a lot of people will remember this record when they hear it. It was a big hit in the summer and into the fall of 64. And one of the standout characteristics of the single was the stomping on the chorus.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, listening back to it, I never remembered it being so boomy.
Yeah. Well, Joe's records, for the most part, had a real pronounced low end, and he got that in a lot of different ways in the studio. In this particular case, he had the Honeycombs line up on the stairwell after they recorded the basic track and had them overdub a group stomp on the record. And, he would use anything and everything to get what he wanted.
This is all really low tech, wasn't it? I mean, didn't he record out of his home?
That's right. He had a studio slash apartment, or an apartment slash studio above a leather goods shop in the Holloway Road section of London. And the quarters were pretty small. He had the main studio room, and right next to that was the control room. But if he couldn't fit the whole performing unit in the studio room, he would sequester the string section or the horns, sometimes actually on the stairwell or downstairs in the living room, his own living room, or for echo effect in the bathroom. And he didn't work with cue lights or talkback monitors, so he would just yell down the stairs or around the corner ready when another take was ready to be done.
He sounds like such an eccentric. Was he taken seriously within the British recording industry?
Well, he was, because he was successful, you see. In the mid-50s, all the records you would hear on the British charts sounded pretty much the same. They were characterized by a large, roomy sound, and the producers and engineers didn't stray too much from the rule book. And most of the records sounded pretty much like a cookie-cutter process. But Joe Meek came along and took the front skin off of a kick drum and the bass drum and stick a mic inside of that and use different ideas for miking and giving a bigger bottom end to a lot of his records and using distortion, which was unheard of. And these things are all pretty commonplace these days. But back then, he was really throwing the rule book away. And at first, there was people in the industry were looking at this and frowning upon it, but he proved to be successful. So people were starting to follow his way of doing things.
He had a tragic ending. What happened?
Yeah, Joe Meek eventually killed himself on February 3rd, 1967. And let me just backtrack a little bit. I did mention that he had this obsession, really, with Buddy Holly, so much that in 1957, I suppose it was, or early 58, through a seance, predicted Buddy Holly's death. Now, Buddy Holly died on February the 3rd, 1959. Joe Meek predicted it to be on February the 3rd, 1958. Rather strange, but he cornered Buddy backstage at a British concert in 1958 after the fact, just to let him know about it, I guess to assure him that everything was okay because February 3rd, 58 had passed. But as it turns out, he did die on that day a year later. For whatever reason, I don't know why Joe chose that day aside from I don't know why he chose to kill himself on the anniversary of Buddy Holly's death, but in fact he did. There were a lot of factors leading up to his demise. The hits stopped coming. He was having money problems. And he was gay, and in his day that was presented problems for him. And he was arrested for publicly importuning. And a lot of this was coming down on him and his use of barbiturates and who knows what other things were attached to it. Some people said he was dealing with black magic. I don't know. I wasn't there. But a lot of different pressures were mounting up. And he ended up, on the morning of February 3rd, 67, summoning up his landlady from the leather goods shop downstairs. Having a bit of a shouting match with her, she tried to calm him down. She turned around to go down the stairs back to her shop, and he shot her dead and turned the gun on himself moments later.
Dennis Dykin is a member of the band The Smithereens. He produced a new CD called It's Hard to Believe It, The Amazing World of Joe Meek, on Razor and Tie Records. This is a tribute to Buddy Holly, produced by Joe Meek, recorded in 1961 by Mike Berry and the Outlaws. Whoa.
But his songs will always be remembered. Always.
This is Fresh Air.